This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We are now the most malnourished region in Ethiopia. Look, the people need help through their system to stand up. I'm not saying bring truckloads of US goods. No, I'm not saying that. Listen to Afar and through them, assist them.
Ethiopia's Afar pastoralists suffer trauma, hunger, displacement, and ongoing crisis in post-war Ethiopia.
And I was raising concerns that Apple's out making all these really public statements about how environmental friendly they are and how, you know, health and safety in the workplace. And I was like, you guys, this is like fraud.
Whistleblower Ashley Jovic reveals that the tech giant Apple colluded with the Environmental Protection Agency and other government agencies to shut down her health and safety complaint.
We're here partly about nuclear submarines, but we're here about war in general and the prospect of Australia, as is predicted by numerous American generals, being at war against China within 2 or 3 years, a most horrendous prospect for us.
Citizens, diplomats, and unions gathered in Wollongong, south of Sydney, Australia, to say no to Port Kembla, its neighboring harbor, hosting AUKUS nuclear submarine technology. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, In Garrison. The Ethiopian Civil War came to an uneasy end in November 2022, with hundreds of thousands of people dead and more than 5 million displaced. It's often called the Tigray War, although it took place in Tigray, Amhara, and Afar regions, and people from all three regions are still suffering its devastating consequences. However, media and, quote, the international community, unquote, are once again focused almost exclusively on Tigray, while Amhara farmers and Afar desert pastoralists are rarely, if ever, even mentioned. I traveled to Afar to witness what had happened to the Afar people in May 2022 during one of several ceasefires. During the first week of April, I followed up with Maalika, whose English name is Valerie Browning. Maalika is an Australian nurse and wife of Afar pastoralist Ismail Aligardo, with whom she founded the Afar Pastoralist Development Association. We talked about post-war Afar and Ethiopia. This is part of our conversation. Okay, the Afar are not one of the three ethnicities who've competed for dominance in Ethiopia. Those are the Tigrayan, the Amhara, and the Oromo. So
sure.
Why did the TPLF attack the Afar so viciously?
And well, what we're all asking ourselves, the only thing we can say is that we had the border with Tigray. They wanted to pass from Tigray through Afar, get the road that connects from the port of Djibouti going down into Ethiopia, cut that road and damage the Ethiopian economy. That's what was one of their main aims. The other issue seems to be that Afar, you're right, it is too small to be in any form of competition for supremacy in Ethiopia. Too small, very small population, but it is ancient volcanic lava land. It is. There's lots of ancient volcanic craters. There's one active crater called Ertali, and all over the place there are minerals and mineral wealth. There's salt to begin with. That's obvious. It's salt on the surface of the land. And a lot. Okay, that's in Afdera and in Dalol and in Dobi. Okay, and then there is gold. Then there is very good quality potash, which has been found. But if more geology investigation, you'd find a lot more for sure. The whole land in the north is made out of kind of like volcanic lava flows.
Right.
But in time that after the volcano erupted, it froze, like right. The heat went out. Yeah, we have bunches of rocks, bunches of boulders. And there's going to be mineral wealth in there for sure, other than what I've said, beyond what I've said.
Is there anything but the salt being mined now? I know that the salt is being mined at Afdera.
Yeah, but nothing else is being mined at the moment. Okay. The community knows about the gold and they locally pan it. They do it by hand. They try and get it. Yeah.
Okay. So there's some artisanal mining, but no industrial mining.
No. Nothing has ever fallen into the hand. This is another factor of the inequality of the country. Nothing to do with the wealth of Afar has ever fallen into the hands of Afar, ever. So, I mean,
Is anyone else extracting it? There's the salt.
Yeah. I mean, the every nationality in Ethiopia is extracting the salt.
Okay.
Years ago, this organization made the first ever salt producing cooperative. And immediately the Ministry of Mining and Energy came rushing in and said, no, this cannot be. No. This is the map of the Salt Lake Afdera. You must be careful, you Afar. We give 95% for investment, which means anybody but Afar, and 5% to you, 5%. And they gave the rockiest, most terrible part to the Afar. And the Afar side of the salt has always been controlled by big boys at the top, who are government and into corruption. The local people of Afdera today are suffering severe malnutrition.
Okay.
The local people of Afar today have measles outbreak. I just saw their health person walk through my door. So, I mean, the situation there is abject poverty in a situation where they should have developed and got enough to build the facilities they require.
If they simply own the salt resources, I know the salt resources there are enormous. If they simply own the salt resources and were able to benefit from them commercially, would that mean a huge advance in their standard of living?
It would change the whole of the north, yes.
Okay.
But no, it's out of, there's a Tigray man called Sagai who became a multi-billionaire on the basis of the salt. He owns now a huge fleet of trucks. He owns everything. So no, the salt has gone to other people.
And did it change hands during the war? Did it change hands before?
Well,
TPLF of course. Were they fighting to regain control? I'm trying to understand why the TPLF came.
There were people from Afar who defected to the side of TPLF. And they were mostly people who put their dirty hand into getting salt for themselves.
Okay.
So salt was a big factor in the war in the first place. And anyway, yeah, the ownership of the salt now, I mean, has gone from Tigray to Amhara, really. I mean, it's nowhere near the Afar yet.
Okay. Then I'm still trying to understand why, aside from this desire to seize the resources, most of all, in this case, the salt mines, why did the TPLF try to destroy the Afar people?
Well, this is not understood by anybody, I don't think. Nobody understands. So, I mean, I don't think, why would you knock out every single health clinic? Why would you cut the water pipes in every water scheme? Why would you bash every school so it becomes a shamble? Pull all the school library books out and tear them up and do all stupid things, you know? So, I mean, the whole thing is an amazing debacle for the Afar. They don't understand, other than some form of Afar tried, some older Afar told me that they thought back in history, before their time, Afar must have done something against the TPLF and they wanted revenge. But I said, I don't know. I mean, really, this is beyond the joke. When they destroy an Afar house, there's a bed inside called an aloita, which is made like a marriage bed. The mother, the marrying girl, her sister, and maybe cousins, they will sit and weave this bed. It's woven from strips of leather into a particular pattern. They went inside and they just put knives through this bed. I mean, what's the point, you know?
That's
very silly. Everybody has their culture. You can't just stick a knife in it. Very silly. Very silly. So, I mean, so it it's absolutely mindless destruction, mindless. So I don't know. I mean, they were obviously ordered from the top of the TPLF because it was so systematic. When they looted the big markets on the border, they took away truckloads of all the goods that were in the market, truckloads and truckloads, till every single shop was left empty. I mean, what's the point? What are you trying to prove?
No, I saw similar kinds of destruction in Amhara that didn't make any sense, that couldn't be understood as anything but attacks on the people.
This is the thing. And Afar have got to try and swallow that one, because obviously it's not going to be taken up by the government or anybody, and there's no compensation either. So Afar have to pick themselves up and move on. Yeah.
Okay. Ask the last question here. The U.S. gave the TPLF narrative and political support throughout the war. In fact, we heard constantly about Tigray genocide, constantly that genocide was being committed against the people of Tigray. There was even fear that the U.S. might intervene militarily over that. Near the end of the war, Mike Hammer, the U.S. envoy to the Horn at the time, arrived to escort TPLF officials to the peace talks where the peace agreement emerged in Pretoria. And during his most recent trip, Antony Blinken, our Secretary of State, met with Prime Minister Abiy and with the TPLF. He then spoke about atrocities committed in Tigray, but I don't believe he even mentioned Afar. Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, I mean, and this is all the debacle of this war. It was as much a war of attrition as it was a war of propaganda. The propaganda hurt the Afar more. I mean, we were told, for example, that the Afar were blocking the humanitarian corridor to get help to Tigray. Yeah. Well, this was, I mean, I went to them. I had all the ambassadors. They called me to their offices. They came here. I went all over the place. I went with the international media. Mm-hmm. And I said, you just got to tell me the geographic place where this has happened, where the trucks have been stopped, because we are not aware. And it was just all built up to say how nasty are the Afar. So in the end of the day, the Afar got nothing from anybody, not the US government, not anybody. Your US government, at one point, they asked me, they begged me to say to the Afar that US government loves them, US government's always supported them. And I kept trying to interrupt this speech that your political man was giving me. I said, well, tell me when and where did you do something for the Afar? I can remind them. I can push them to think about it. But no, we had nothing, but Afar is bad. Afar is on the wrong side. Afar started this and started that. The whole media line was a pro-TPLF line, 100% from the beginning to the end. And this, to us, is unreconcilable. We've no idea. We've no idea. And other than the fact Afar are maybe 2.3, 2.4 million people, very small, land very valuable, geographically valuable on the Red Sea, close to the Middle East, close to Djibouti, but people of no interest. No interest to the world, apparently. So it was very, very difficult to live through that time. Very difficult.
When I was there, I saw truck after truck after truck headed north to Tigray. And I asked drivers, were they having any trouble getting through? They all said no. And then I heard Afar saying that the trucks weren't stopping to help them. They were just going through to Tigray. While we were hearing that all the aid convoys to Tigray were being blocked.
Well, there were 80 and more trucks going daily through the Afar land while the Afar was starving. I was trying to organize assistance as a very small contribution assistance from relatives, from friends, from go help me, internet raise funding, whatever was possible.
Okay.
But the whole thing was awful. We lost many people dead from malnutrition also in the time of the conflict. We did.
Okay, well, is there anything else you'd like to say you'd like Americans to know about what has happened to Afar and the role that the U.S. has played in it?
Well, it would be really nice if the world listened to the Afar, not made up their own scenario just to suit them. This would be really good. Afar should be part of Ethiopia. They fought for Ethiopia. They stopped the TPLF taking Addis Ababa. They did a lot in that conflict to save the nation. We don't have a nation, by the way. But at the end of the day, people should see things in balance. The TPLF did horrendous things. A spade should be called a spade. And destroying the livelihood, now we are starting from a very low level to build up again. We are now the most malnourished region in Ethiopia. Now, how did that happen? It's horrible. I mean, we have children dying daily. We have pregnant mothers dying. They can't give birth to the baby. They're too weak. We are in a real mess. So, look, the people need help through their system to stand up. I'm not saying bring truckloads of US goods. No, I'm not saying that. Listen to AFA and through them, assist them. But really, don't go the other way, because you've destroyed and you're going to make a worse mess. You are.
The other way, you mean aid just coming in and being dumped?
Well, yeah, just dropping from the top and saying, listen, have these plastic buckets. Listen, have this and have that. I mean, they call a thing called a dignity kit for women. How dare they call it a dignity kit? We have enough dignity anyway. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. And nobody asked the AFA if they wanted menstrual hygiene sets. Nobody asked them. Mm-hmm. They just have to receive them when they're hungry. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And stop supporting politically. I mean, I know how the TPLF ran the war and who helped them from the inside. I do know. Yeah. And it was allowed, apparently. At the end of the day, it's over. We'll build the country again. We'll get back on our feet and we'll work hard. But now, yes, we do need to get from our side, from our perspective, assistance, but not manufactured in New York or in Washington, D.C., an idea. Come here, find out what's needed, and give in a realistic way.
That was Malika, co-founder of the Afar Pastoralist Development Association in Afar Region, Ethiopia. She is also known by her English name, Valerie Browning. That was Afar Music of Ethiopia, and this is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Apple's senior engineer and programming manager, Ashley Jovic, discovered a toxic Superfund site below her offices at Apple in Silicon Valley after it made her sick. She tried to get Apple to test the building and take care of it, but she was fired. She now has evidence that Apple was colluding with the Environmental Protection Agency and other government agencies to silence her. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
So it all started, which I thought was kind of unrelated to the Apple story, but turns out is very related. In 2020, when I moved into a new apartment complex in Santa Clara, California. So Silicon Valley is a cluster of these suburban cities, and Santa Clara is one of them. Santa Clara was used probably out of all those cities the most for semiconductor manufacturing in the 70s and 80s. So it's pretty polluted. But these apartments, they looked like luxury apartments, beautiful. They didn't tell us that they built it on top of a Superfund groundwater plume and its own local contamination in the soil and water and all of this. So there's that one. But then also my Apple office was on a Superfund site. which I was warned by a friend when I moved into that office in 2017. I'd been at Infinite Loop in Cupertino, and this was a different office. And they like kind of whispered to me of, this is a super fun site. I didn't even know what that meant at the time. And then after I go through this experience in 2020, some weird stuff happens at my office. I start asking questions and I know how this stuff works. And come to find out, I got sick at both of these places. I had started, the first painting spell was 2019 at my office. And at that point, I had no idea what it was about. I was working full time at Apple and in law school 3/4 time. So I just assumed it was stress because I was pushing myself so hard. But I've never fainted like that before. And it only occurred in the office. And then when I moved in that apartment, I was on short-term disability for about 5 months. I was so sick. They were screening me for fatal illnesses. They thought I could have MS. It was terrifying. And as soon as I moved out, I was better. And then because of COVID, we were working remotely. So I wasn't yet having to return back to that office, but we were getting close to that as well. And I was not terribly excited to go back to one of these sites after what I just experienced without being reassured of the safety. And then disaster unfolds.
The idea that, you know, on the surface, it looks very clean and well done and everything else, but beneath the surface, literally, is a Superfund site. The idea of a Superfund site being under your building and you're not knowing about it. I mean, it must have been terrifying that this is happening and you're trying to protect yourself and the fellow workers.
Fellow workers at my office and my fellow workers, a lot of them were living at this apartment complex too. Like I wrote an article in SF Bayview when I figured out it was on the Superfund site, this remediated site. And while later developments will discover, it might have not actually been that hazardous waste that made me sick. It could be a newer version that probably made me sick. But it's like, you should still tell us. And there's ongoing risk because there's other plumes nearby that can migrate. So they didn't tell us. And my site, specifically my office, is on what's called the triple site in Sunnyvale because it's three Superfund site plumes that merge into a mega plume. But the name needs updated because it also merged with at least like 3 or 4 other plumes. So it was like this two kilometer long, 2 mile long. And then now it's like also like 2 mile wide. It's this really gross area and it's very shallow. So it can evaporate up into buildings and is like houses and apartments and stuff too. So this stuff is really dangerous. And all of a sudden I'm like, you know, you should tell us also just practically, because if there's vapor intrusion, like me fainting, I should have told EHS. Because then it could tip off our HS team to go do testing and make sure everything's okay, or if we smell something. And they explicitly told me we had no right to know.
So you discovered that there was a toxic dump site at the Apple offices, and you tried to get them to test it, to have tests from the EPA and to find out.
I found out, so I knew it was a Superfund site, like quietly, and I had been whispering with coworkers, like we were uncomfortable, they weren't telling us about it and being transparent, but we felt like if we actually said anything, we'd get in trouble leading up to it. And then I had gone through this apartment experience, found out it was a bunch of toxic waste, learned how vapor intrusion works. And then Apple sends this email in to myself and then the management team in March of 2021 saying they wanted to test the office for vapor intrusion, but didn't say it was a Superfund or explain what vapor intrusion was or anything like that. And that's when I was like, okay, it's good you're testing, but have you not been testing? Because we've been here since 2015. Were you not testing that entire time? And then I'm asking like the logistical questions, because I learned also there's different levels of the testing that was done at East Palestine. They went out of their way to not actually test, right? They're using tests that weren't going to pick up the stuff and they were doing a very short duration. They play games with this stuff. So I was asking questions, trying to figure out how they plan to test. Were they going to share the results? And quickly, they did not like any of my questions. And as I was digging in the documentation, I realized they hadn't been testing since, you know, they moved people in. And there was a long history of vapor intrusion in the building. The building is vacant and gutted for over a decade before Apple rented and put humans inside.
So they actually knew, Apple, that this building site had some problems.
So Apple was the ones that were like actually, you know, building it out, but had to follow all these rules, partnering with the responsible party, who was Northrop Grumman, to make sure that they follow all the CERCLA rules. And so like the test reports from 2014, 15 have Apple's name on them too. So Apple was fully aware.
And you then went to EPA, not only EPA, you went to OSHA, you went to many agencies to file charges that you've been illegally discharged. You've been retaliated against for being a whistleblower.
Before I was fired. So I could tell I was going to be fired when I was suspended, and them suspending me was like any moment now they're going to, you know, do something terrible. So, and this makes it even worse because they knew I had filed these before they fired me. So I had filed NLRB charges, U.S. Department of Labor retaliation charges for a Superfund whistleblower, OSHA, SOX, I'd filed an SEC charge. And Apple knew about all of these. They were covered in the press. And then they send a workplace violence interrogator emailing me with like no subject line, demanding I get on the phone with them within the hour. I literally ask if we can keep it in writing. I say, because I have my federal affidavit tomorrow with the NLRB. This feels like federal witness intimidation. I'd like to forward our exchange to the NLRB. Workplace violence says, because you chose not to participate in our investigation, we're suspending all your account access. And then like 3 hours later, I get an email from my like vice president with a letter saying I'm fired, saying I violated company policies.
And you begin to discover that, in fact, their former government officials, including from the EPA, who actually have been hired by Apple and are involved in your issues.
Which I had been worried about, and it was confirmed later on, you know, that I was asking, because they were acting so crazy, like really just outright crazy. And they're writing it in emails. Like, one of the reasons they've been so awful to me for 2 years now, it's been a living hell, but I feel like I'm in a very unique position as a whistleblower just to have so many documents of them incriminating themselves that I can give to the regulators. You know, doesn't happen that often, but I think they were just, you know, going so nuts because I was pushing a lot of spots, like pointing out that they had hired Lisa Jackson, who used to run the US EPA. She resigned in disgrace due to FOIA controversies and whistleblower retaliation, which became appropriate. And she brought over a bunch of her EPA staff as well, which works with her in the lobbying organization. So like that was a conflict I was asking about. And I was raising concerns that Apple's out making all these really public statements about how environmental friendly they are and how, you know, health and safety in the workplace. And I was like, you guys, this is like fraud. Because clearly by everything you're telling me, you're not any of those things, right? Like when I pushed on them about, you know, telling us about the exposure at the workplace and all this, they said they don't do anything beyond what is legally required.
I think I've heard that term before for other whistleblowers. You know, is that Becky McLean, who is a molecular biologist at Pfizer, where there was a biological leak in her laboratory, was told that by Pfizer. We only do as much as the law requires. You know, it sounds like it's a common operating procedure for them to tell workers who are concerned about their health and safety, we're only going to follow the letter of the law.
The trouble for them now, though, is that SEC is taking these ESG statements more seriously, the environmental social governance statements that companies will make in their little like annual shareholder things where they say how wonderful they are and everything they do is perfect. The SEC is saying, people are really actually caring about things like the climate and environment and safety now. So if you're lying on that stuff, we're actually going to say that shareholder fraud now, because people might be buying your shares because they think you're a good company.
You file these complaints and you are processing them. You won the NLRB decision and you've been able to get some documentation that actually shows the real role of government agencies, which should be protecting you.
So like everything we just talked about, right, already sounds really damning. Maybe like, please don't fire me. This feels like witness intimidation, Mr. Workplace Violence. And he's like, you're fine. You know, already it sounds crazy. And so I'd expect that I would go to the government and they would see this stuff and be like, what the actual hell is going on there, right? And go run and be like, Apple, what are you doing to her? But instead they're like obstructive and retaliating against me more and like telling me not to file charge it, all this really weird behavior. To start with, the EPA has been incredibly adversarial in trying to getting these documents released. I filed their first request January 2022, and there's still one of them that's still open that they refuse to give me the remainder of the documents. And they've like threatened me multiple times that they're going to charge me as like commercial, which could be like thousands of dollars to even get these documents that are like about my whistleblower claims. This punky lawyer was trying to tell me that like it's a commercial interest for me to want to be compensated for my harm, for my termination.
Sounds like you're dealing directly with the employer. Those are employer.
I am, you know, right? I am, right? That was what I had to come to terms with. Because, I mean, even the revolving door, they want to keep a good relationship with these industries because oftentimes they want to go work for them after their current job because they can make a lot more money. So there's like just inherent coercion if there's not actual collusion. I learned that as soon as I contacted EPA in April They immediately notified Apple, Northrop Grumman Corporation, and the building owner, CalSTRS, that I did so. And we're actually like drafting a draft email to send to me telling me they ratted me out as a whistleblower to all of them as like their immediate response, which is wild. Apparently because I had called and like writ my, you know, questions down in email, they had an email like, oh, shucks, she got to it before we could. So then they had to actually like answer them, which is crazy. And then it sounds like they were like, actually, oh, maybe we should pay attention to this site. So it's out. So the EPA took the site over in 2015-16. It had been run by the state, but it was such a risk to public health that the EPA wanted to take primary ownership of it. But that's when the Trump administration came in and the EPA was gutted and just like everything was ignored. So it sounds like the site really had not had attention like for a very long time. So they're starting to request documents from Northrop and looking through them and asking a bunch of questions that I had asked. What's going on here? Are you paying attention to this? What's going on? And so that's happening. They met with Apple in April, had a couple phone calls to try to figure out how to respond to me. And mind you, Apple's not even party on this office. It's owned by CalSTRS. The responsible party is Northrop Grumman. Apple's a tenant, but the EPA reached out directly to Apple to figure out how to respond to me about my concerns about a federal Superfund site. And mind you, that's April. So that's like right before my boss is like, tells me I can just quit Apple and he's gonna take all my projects away. And so I was like, oh no. So they knew, and it really was like, they were pissed. So when I complained to the regulators that Apple was telling me not to talk to my coworkers about safety, Apple denied that. And they're like, oh, we never. There's emails though of like them saying it in like the 5-point balancing test, if I want to talk about safety, that they just reduced to a 3-point balancing test after I like grieved about it. So like it was still pretty well documented. But then, you know, what else helps is an actual copy of the 4-page NDA they tried to make the EPA sign. This is everything about the inspection is confidential and EPA can't make any public statements about it. Only Apple can. And one thing that the EPA apparently like drew the line on, because their email to the lawyer was like, we're not signing their NDA. So it was bad enough with this showing that they immediately outed me to these companies and told them that, you know, I'm trying to blow the whistle and like work with them on how to respond to my concerns that were like you directed to the EPA. But like another thing that came back, like a day before that inspection, Lisa Jackson had arranged to bring over the current head of the EPA to Apple Park for a fireside chat, which was like, per the emails, a very last minute request, which sounds like, we come to my panopticon. I'd like to intimidate you here and show you how powerful I am now at Apple, please. Because they've gotten in trouble. I've found actually a lot of hazardous waste trouble too. So they're probably really trying to avoid any kind of action on this. So they have their little fireside chat. And then I'm like curious because I saw the press coverage and I'm like, are they talking ongoing? Because that was her prior job. So I did FOIA requests asking like, what are they talking about? Are they talking? And they were. They had several meetings, like one-on-one meetings. She had requested and tried to go on site to like the EPA headquarters to meet with him, which I assume was her wanting to walk around and intimidate all of her ex-staff. Also like weird, but like the worst one I found in November of 2021, the head of the regional office overseeing these San Francisco Bay sites had left. So they were looking for a new person and she wrote a letter of recommendation for the person she wanted to oversee that regional EPA office. It'd be an executive level position overseeing most of Apple's offices. And she sent the letter from her Apple email account. There's either like very clear inferred evidence of collusion and over deference or obstruction. And then sometimes just this like damning letter of recommendation, which is just so crazy. So I've had to reckon a lot with just how we live in a plutocracy, come to find out, and the whole like whistleblower hero is a sham. And, you know, you have an ethical obligation to bring stuff forward when you see it, but you will just be like stoned to death once you do, generally, which sucks. And it makes me really upset. So that's why I've kind of taken on this like tertiary battle of the corruption in addition to the retaliation, in addition to the safety issues. Because it's so upsetting to me to see how this stuff is buried and people are harmed so much for just trying to do the right thing.
That was fired Apple senior engineer and programming manager, Ashley Jovic, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. is music by Natalia Lafourcade. The Republican-led states of Florida, West Virginia, and Missouri have announced that they are leaving Electronic Registration Information Center, also known as ERIC, a group of roughly 30 states on both sides of the partisan aisle who assist one another in maintaining accurate voter rolls. Joshua Epstein from Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, has more.
Elections. They are a fundamental piece of democracy. But how do the folks working the polls know who they can take a ballot from? To put it simply, election workers are given a list of who's eligible to vote. Since April of 2019, Florida has used the Electronic Registration Information Center, known by its acronym ERIC, to ensure that its voter rolls are accurate. But last month, three Republican-led states, including Florida, announced that they are pulling out of ERIC, leaving questions about the future of a system that up until recently was a bipartisan success story. There are also questions about how these three states will maintain accurate voter lists without this resource. ERIC is a multi-state partnership that experts across the political spectrum say is the only reliable, secure way for states to share voter registration data with each other. ERIC was launched in 2012 by election officials from a bipartisan group of seven states. Its membership has since grown to 31 states in Washington, D.C. Simply put, the mission of ERIC is to improve the accuracy of eligible voter rolls through a state-run voter monitoring system in which states periodically submit their voter rolls for review. The system then identifies incorrect and outdated voter information. At least every 60 days, all ERIC member states submit their voter rolls for auditing. The partnership allows states to use and share government data from election offices as well as the Department of Motor Vehicles and the Social Security Administration to eliminate dead voters from the rolls, provide election offices with tips on whether a voter has moved to another state, find anyone registered to vote in more than one state, and find anyone in any federal election who illegally voted twice. According to election officials, the system has worked miracles for their ability to keep their rolls up to date. Cecile Schoon, the president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, told me that she thinks Florida leaving the ERIC partnership is going to be detrimental to its ability to keep its voter rolls up to date.
Well, I think it's devastating to our ability to maintain accurate voter rolls. Very, very concerning. I've spoken with several ERIC experts and people who know about ERIC, and what they tell me, there is absolutely nothing in comparison that can be used that is as broad, that is as safe and as secure and is accepted in a bipartisan manner, except for the recent pullout. So then when you ask yourself, what are they going to use? That becomes a very scary problem.
Between 2012 and 2017, when the partnership did not yet include the 23 states that joined in 2019 and 2020, ERIC found 26.5 million improper registrations, including incidents of wrong addresses, voters moving out of state, duplicates, and deceased registered voters. In 2017 alone, ERIC found 8.4 million discrepancies. Mike Bennett, the supervisor of elections in Manatee County, talked through with me which tools that his office used under ERIC to keep his voter rolls up to date he will now lose access to.
What we have to do is go back to our old ways to clean up our voting rolls here in Manatee County. And we've always been very successful at crisscrossing them. In fact, as we are doing it right now, we send our voting rolls, our voting registers, to a local vendor. The local vendor gets the information from the U.S. Post Office, and we cross them over. And we see that, you know, your address says Broward County, but you're here, so the post office would pick that up. We will follow up with you saying, hey, we got a problem. Which address is yours? And are you still resident in here in Manatee County, or have you moved to Orange County?
Is that communication that occurs only within the state of Florida or on a national level?
Just in the state of Florida.
Say I lived in Ohio and moved here. They'd registered to vote in Ohio. Now that ERIC is gone, how are you going
I would not have a way to verify that. We would send Ohio where you were last residence, you are now registered to vote down here. If they're not part of ERIC, if they're not part of looking at the system, if they're not paying attention to what we're sending them. There's nothing I can do to verify that you're no longer registered in Ohio.
Come the 2024 election, is there anyone, now that Florida doesn't participate in Eric, that'll have the ability to make sure that individuals don't vote in two states for the President of the United States exists?
There's no longer an organized, that I'm aware of, there's no longer an organized system to do that.
Does Florida pulling out of Eric change your ability to eliminate dead voters from the roll?
No, it doesn't eliminate it, because we check literally daily the obits, okay? We get daily reports, continuous reports from the health department of people who died, okay? And we're continuously looking through those to make sure that Sam Jones died. Is he a registered voter with us? Can we verify that this is the same Sam Jones?
When you said you get the obituaries, you're able to see who dies. Is that only within Florida, or if someone dies in Ohio, do you still find out?
No, we don't find out about it. There's no crisscross system.
And so Eric was the crisscross system.
Eric was it.
So why is Florida leaving Eric? When announcing the end of Florida's involvement in Eric, Secretary of State Cory Burt, an appointee of Governor Ron DeSantis, said on March 6th that Florida is dropping out because of perceived partisanship. Burt said in a prepared statement that the decision stemmed from Eric's rejection of proposals by a working group to eliminate, quote, potential partisan leanings. Burt said that the working group sought to increase protections of confidential voter information and to limit the power of ex officio members of the Eric board who are, quote, not representatives of specific states and have undue influence over the organization and its decisions. Burt said Florida has, quote, tried to back reforms to increase protections, but these protections were refused. Therefore, we have lost confidence in Eric, end quote. Bennett, the Manatee County Supervisor of Elections, is an avid Republican who also served in the State House from 2000 to 2002 and the State Senate from 2002 to 2012. He told me in the interview that while he has a lot of confidence in Secretary of State Byrd, he can't understand why Florida is leaving Eric. According to Bennett, the system is not used for partisan purposes.
And when they decided this year to eliminate it, I never got a straight answer of why. Okay. I still don't know why they eliminated it. I don't know what specific issues they had with Eric. Was there something nefarious going on? I'm still waiting for that answer. And several people in our association of Florida Supervisor of Elections, we have not been given a clear definition yet. And I have lots of faith in Tallahassee. Hope that Secretary Byrd has got it backed up a notch. But I think that it's one of those things that started with, I think it was Louisiana was the first one to bail, and then Georgia. And people just were running gun shy, didn't want to be the last one to get out, just like they didn't want to be the last one to get in. So I can't give you a definite reason from the state of Florida. And I've never got a definite reason that I personally believe that it's going to hurt efforts to combat voter fraud, because it was a source of information. And to lose that source of information could prove to be a problem later on.
Probably what Secretary of State Cory Burt was talking about when he said that the system had, quote, potential partisan leanings, is that one of the requirements in Eric is to identify voters who could potentially be eligible to vote but are not registered, and then to send them postcards, giving them information on how they could register. Abdelia Skier, a voting rights policy strategist with the ACLU of Florida, told me that Florida complied with that provision in 2020, but not in 2022, and that Florida, now that they're leaving Eric, will no longer have to comply with that provision. He said that this is just another example of how leaving Eric is going to harm Floridians.
One of the requirements of membership in Eric was to identify voters who could potentially be eligible to vote, but unregistered. So mailing them postcards and giving them information on how to register to vote was part of the ERIC agreement. Ultimately, it's just a disservice to Floridians in general. I don't see anything wrong with giving people information on registering to vote. And
Alice Nulon, the president of the League of Women Voters of Manatee County, told me that she thinks one of the biggest losses from Florida leaving ERIC is the missed opportunity to have people see that our election systems are safe and secure and that the principle of one person, one vote is respected.
Well, I think to preserve our democracy, it is imperative that people believe and understand that our voting systems are safe and secure and fair. And this was an excellent opportunity not only to do something that advantages all the supervisors of elections, but it also was an excellent opportunity for the public to understand that there are systems in place that make the voting system secure and make it so it's one person, one vote. And this, I mean, I would have loved to have seen, or the League would have loved to have seen this publicized even more. So I think, you know, that, you know, basically saving democracy, we got to have people believe in the elections. And this is a big loss for that.
That was Joshua Epstein, a Pacifica affiliate, WSLR, Sarasota, Florida.
In the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, kill him, he's a hero. Get it to the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship him, don't let him deal with brothers. Give him guns, step back, watch him kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brothers, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on, come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
I want to be only way I've been.
That was Tupac, Changes. Citizens, diplomats, and unions gathered in Wollongong, south of Sydney, Australia, to say no to Port Kembla, its neighboring harbor, hosting AUKUS nuclear submarine technology. Under the AUKUS plan, Australia would pay the US and UK to build and deliver three nuclear submarines by the early 2030s to the port of Kembla. The protesters also said no to a hostile foreign policy towards China. Meanwhile, no plan has been announced by the government regarding disposal of the high-grade nuclear waste that would be generated by the submarines. Here is part of a consortium news report.
I'm a union organizer at the University of Wollongong, and I can tell you that staff and students are horrified by the prospect of nuclear subs sitting in our port.
For 34 years, I was an Australian diplomat. I was ambassador in Vietnam, in South Korea, in Mexico and Cuba. I've never been in a situation that we're now in. This is an existential problem. The United States is pressuring Australia to buy nuclear-propelled submarines to be based here at Port Kembla. The only purpose for these submarines, ladies and gentlemen, is for war against China. If that happens, it will be an apocalypse. And Australia will suffer. The United States can always withdraw across the Pacific. We can't. This is our neighborhood. As Paul Keating said, we should be building our security within the region, not against the region.
Absolutely. Alison Bronowski, we're in Wollongong, in Port Kembla. talking about nuclear submarines.
We're here partly about nuclear submarines, but we're here about war in general and the prospect of Australia, as is predicted by numerous American generals, being at war against China within 2 or 3 years, a most horrendous prospect for us. This is in our region. This is where we live. This is where we have to continue to live while the Americans can retreat across the Pacific if they want. We don't want to be involved in this. And the AUKUS agreement is one way in which government is positioning Australia to be involved.
Right. So the workers at Port Kembla, this being one of the potential sites, they're kind of worried about using the technology. Is it dangerous for the workers?
Nuclear technology is dangerous for everybody, wherever it is. And that's why one of the reasons why we don't have nuclear power plants, because they'd have to be around the coast. And there is no area where the local government would say they want a nuclear power plant in their region. Mm. We can't dispose of the waste we have already. We couldn't dispose of the waste from nuclear submarines. We have no idea how we're going to do that, and the government doesn't either.
When we talk about that opportunity on climate change, and the opposition and the warmongers in this building talk about the opportunity for jobs out of a US Navy nuclear subspace, they need to know, based on New South Wales Treasury figures, there are $243 billion lined up investment in renewable energy technologies that will transform our city, transform our port, and help to transform and save our planet. That's where the real jobs are. That's where the real future is for our city and for our planet.
The conference that we're here protesting today is not a defense conference. It's the potential base for nuclear submarines is not about defense either. This is about militarism. We can't let the sanitized terms confuse us. Nuclear submarines are not strategic assets or defense assets. They're weapons of war. The proposal for $368 billion to be spent on nuclear-powered submarines is a scam of the system of militarism. It's a manufactured crisis.
We need to make sure that Wollongong is the epicenter of the opposition to the AUKUS plan.
It's the biggest land-based weapons expo in the Southern Hemisphere. They tried to have it in Brisbane in 2020, COVID disrupted it. Then they had it in Brisbane in 2021, and we disrupted it. And then they had it in Brisbane again in 2022, and they had, like, they must have quadrupled their security budget. They had, like, an 8-foot fence around the convention centre. They had 600 cocks on shifts of 200 at a time defending a conference centre full of arms dealers from a bunch of peaceniks. How ironic is that? How ironic is that? This year, in 2023, they announced that they will no longer be holding land forces in Brisbane. So we kicked them out of Brisbane, we can kick them out of Wollongong, and I want to just let you guys know and let Wawan know that Wage Peace, our network all up and down and across and left to right on this continent, we're with you, we thank you, we're sending you our love and our gratitude and our solidarity and our support, and we're going to be with you every step of the way. Thanks so much for being here, everyone.
Those were voices from the protest against the Australian Port Kembla hosting AUKUS nuclear submarines, as reported by Kathy Vogan for Consortium News. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ian Garrison. Thanks for listening.